This is the Human Action Podcast with your hosts, Jeff Deist and Dr. Bob Murphy.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Human Action Podcast, joined as always by my friend and colleague, Dr. Bob Murphy. And we are, as you might imagine, going to dissect the financial news of the week a little bit. This FTX scandal is really dominating, I won't say the headlines. It's dominating Twitter. And I think one of the reasons it's not going to dominate the headlines is one of the key actors, Sam Bankman-Fried, was a Democratic mega donor. As a matter of fact, he was the second largest individual donor to the Joe Biden 2020 campaign behind one George Soros. And he apparently gave about $40 million during this last 2020 midterm cycle to Democratic House and Senate candidates. So as a result of that, and because of some of his friendships with people like Maxine Waters, I do think the mainstream media will try to downplay this story and make it go away to an extent. But all that said, you know, Bob, as I look at the big picture around this, a few things come to mind. We'll get to some of these during the show. First of all, is just this idea of the financialization of the economy. How is it possible that these kinds of leverages are being engaged in by presumably smart people getting investment funds from other smart people? Second, are we going to suffer from a whole new regulatory landscape as a result of this? If we think back to the Enron scandal, for example, that resulted in a lot of new legislation, including the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, which from my perspective did very little to make investors any safer, but it absolutely enriched whole armies of lawyers and accountants. It also brought potential criminal liability to the C-suite of publicly traded corporations, people who sign off on audits and tax returns. But it also raises some questions about what Mises termed circulation credit versus commodity credit, you know, fractional reserve banking, leveraging money to get a return. I think that's an issue here, for especially for our audience. And finally, my fear, Bob, is that all of this might lead regulators and central bankers to say, well, gee whiz, these cryptos are here to stay, so we ought to control them. We can't just let all these cowboy private firms do so, these tech bros. So let's have central bank digital currencies. And you know, you and I have had shows on that in the past, but there's a huge amount of danger for libertarians from central bank digital currency. So look, maybe we should start with this financialization question. I mean, this $32 billion valuation of FTX was clearly pie in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff, like you say, it's difficult. So I'm not going to go full Peter Schiff. You know, as people know, I have a booklet I wrote on Bitcoin, the economics of it. And, you know, I have never been one to just say, oh, it's intrinsically worth nothing. But there is, whatever you think of that, you know, there is a lot of leeway when it comes to the crypto world, where it is hard to come up with a, quote, rational valuation of something. Because, you know, if everybody mm-hmm. tomorrow thinks Bitcoin collectively they're worth $10 trillion, they would be. And there's, you know, there's no real scientific or rational reason to distinguish one valuation from the other in that realm. It doesn't mean it's all completely worthless or useless, but again, it's hard to pin it down because they're not making cars or something. So it's difficult to say. But yes, I mean, just 2019, I think he founded that firm. And as people mm-hmm. can see, it's, you know, he's sort of, they bought into the mystique, I guess, that if you, now with in hindsight, looking back at some of his interviews, I mean, it's shocking just how much the press was fawning over him and what he was saying. Like, a lot of it was just kind of goofy. It was almost like he was saying things that he was so unpolished that they thought he was profound, you know, and I don't know, you know, is it just he was being earnest and it worked because people are so used to, you know, like somebody who's a car salesman or what? But yeah, it does seem like a lot of people just for whatever reason, just putting all their chips on this guy, let these huge valuations go. And obviously, in retrospect, that was not a good bet to make.
Well, it reminds me somewhat of the Madoff environment. Now, the difference, of course, is that we can chalk that up to pure greed. And that was an actual literal Ponzi scheme. But nonetheless, there was this insider element, this idea that we're going to be making 10 or 15 or 20% returns while the little people are mm-hmm. making 5% returns. So that seems too good to be true, and it actually was. Now, we don't yet know. There's been a bankruptcy filing by FTX. There may or may not be criminal charges brought against Mr. Bankman-Fried for fraud or whatever it might be. There might be some jurisdictional questions because FTX was based in the Bahamas. Now, it does have an affiliate entity, Alameda Research, based in the U.S. So we don't yet know what sort of criminal charges, if any, are coming. But nonetheless, we do have some information from the bankruptcy filing. And you get the feeling that not only was this too good to be true type stuff, but there was also this element among very smart people, like Paradigm, which is a crypto venture fund, Sequoia, which is a big venture capital fund, even certain pension funds, that they were just suspending their normal due diligence obligations, that they weren't taking a good hard look at the corporate governance of FTX. They weren't wanting FTX to be diversified. They weren't considering the nepotism or alleged drug use or other things going on within this company. We're getting more and more details now about the internal treasury function was almost non-existent. They were outsourcing everything to third-party accountants. I mean, you know, it strikes me that this is the kind of basic blocking and tackling any of us as an investor in, let's say, just an index fund, or any of us who maybe have a 401k or some pension money in a large institutional investment fund, as a lot of average people do, we would expect the people running those funds to be doing this kind of really basic due diligence. And it sounds like this was not done.
Right. And just to give an example for those who haven't looked at what I'm saying a minute ago, you go back and look at some of these interviews and you're just astonished. Like, how come red flag? And yeah, one of them, FTX had just like bailed out some companies. And the interviewer is asking, like, well, so what principles did you use? Or, you know, what criteria do you use when you're looking to decide whether we're going to bail a company out? And he said something that's not an exact quote, but something along the lines of, well, I mean, we got to make sure that the investment's at least mediocre for us to proceed. Like, that was the word. And you would think investors would say, what the heck?
Yeah.
So there's that element. There's this, I don't know if paradox is the right word, or it's ironic at the very least, where the government comes and it regulates a certain activity because it says, oh, we couldn't have wildcat unregulated markets. That would be chaotic. Then because of that, I think a lot of people, they don't have the same level of inquisitiveness and due diligence, like you say, because they kind of assume, well, I mean, the government's there. They couldn't be just doing something completely crazy. And then especially when you have something huge like Madoff's, you know, with operation at its peak, FTX at its peak. And I think people just sort of assume, well, I mean, the whole thing couldn't be built on a house of cards. Look how big it, whereas if, you know, some guy just approached them in a dark alley and said, hey, I got this new coin. Do you want to invest in, you know, people would be wary, but this huge thing that's worth multi-billions of dollars and that, you know, CNBC interviews the guy every other day, you'd think, no, that's gotta be pretty much, you know, top down, pretty much in the light. And again, with Madoff, just a real quick thing before we move on from that topic. Remember, everybody, in case this wasn't on your radar, that there were private watchdogs that were writing to the SEC and telling them, I'm looking at this guy Madoff's, you know, prospectus. This, it has to be a Ponzi scheme. Mm. It was Harry Markopoulos, I think, was the guy who was writing for, I believe, years. And the SEC, not only did they not act on it, but Madoff was like on their ethics committee or something. Like, so this wasn't, so this, there's this tendency that no matter what the level of regulation is that it's ostensibly needed because, oh, wildcat unregulated markets would be crazy. Then when something happens, then that's attributed to laissez-faire capitalism. And that's why we need more regulation. So it's like, no matter what happens, it's always the fault of capitalism, not the actual system that was in operation.
Right. And more importantly, why wasn't that magic regulation or law passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis that would have prevented this? Right. I mean, what regulations are they going to write now that are going to prevent the next one? And I think the important point here is to understand that this regulatory framework simply gives investors a false sense of security. I mean, that's the ultimate effect, is to make people, whether that's FDIC insurance in your bank or whether it's SEC looking at something like a big investment fund or whether it's just looking at whatever company's SEC filings to try to judge a public company. I mean, we know that a lot of shenanigans take place. And we know that a lot of shenanigans took place with Enron, for example. They were hiding a huge amount of debt off their balance sheet. But guess who else does that? Uncle Sam. All of that Social Security and Medicare unfunded liability in the future, that's not debt on the federal government's balance sheet. So if Uncle Sam had to follow GAAP, we might have some people taken away in handcuffs from the federal government. Now, I want to get a little bit more into this idea of Bankman-Fried himself. I mean, where does he come from? He's sort of a wunderkind. He just apparently turned 30 this year. And what I don't like is when the financial press talks about losses in terms of unrealized capital gains or losses. In other words, at one point, FTX was supposedly worth $32 billion. Okay, but that doesn't mean anything on except on paper. So if you sold at that time, you did very, very well. But if you didn't, do you really have a loss? I mean, they listed his net worth at one point at $26 billion, and now it's dropped, the single biggest drop in a day for any billionaire. This is according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. And here's what cracks me up is that even with this 94% drop in his alleged net worth, his paper net worth, he's still worth $991.5 million, at least as we stand today, as he's living still unmolested in the Bahamas. And I think that gets him down into about Bob Murphy net worth territory, $991 million. So I think I could get by on that. And the fact that he was donating to, you know, it was Democrats. If I wanted to be a big shot in this world, I'd donate to Democrats too, because they're the ones who run everything. Was he at the same time basically buying either regulation which would benefit and solidify FTX's position as an industry leader, or keep FTX from, keep regulators at bay? I mean, who knows? Will all of that come out? It's not in the bankruptcy filing. And you just wonder, even the Jim Cramers of the world were touting this guy, the Maxine Waters of the world were touting this guy. What's the process for making sure that scammers like this, don't get away with it? Well, it's criminal prosecution. It's bankruptcy for the investors. It's very painful life lessons for anyone who got involved with FTX. That's it. That's the regulator. That's the market mechanism. The idea that we're going to create a regulatory framework, and when I say we, I mean a bunch of 75-year-olds on the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee, which, by the way, is chaired by Bankman-Fried's buddy, Maxine Waters. I mean, these people don't know anything more about this than any of us. In fact, they probably know less, at least with the Human Action Podcast audience. So, I mean, there are going to be manias. It's just part of the human condition. There are going to be scammers. There are going to be charmers. There are going to be wunderkinds. And this idea that we need a regulatory response, I think, is just absolutely disastrously wrong.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jeff, that, again, it's, when it comes down to it, the actual harm done, if someone took money and then that's lost, it is what it is, and no amount of, ex post action by the government can undo the loss. All they can do is spread the loss elsewhere, spread it among other people. And so, yes, other things equal, when you say what's the best system for allocating that, you would think it would be that people should bear it, make the decisions, right? And so, yes, if, like you say, if the government comes in and says, oh, don't worry, we're going to relieve you of the responsibility. If something goes wrong, we'll make you whole. Well, then the people, when they entrust their money or their wealth to somebody, they're not going to be as diligent on the front end. And that's exactly what we see happening. And also, too, again, it would be one thing if you didn't know anything about the history of financial regulation and crises and so on. You might understandably think, well, it can't hurt to just have some more regulators looking over people's shoulders and just making sure everything's tip top. But in practice, no, that isn't what happens. And you mentioned Sarbanes-Oxley before, and a lot of the big firms were for that. And, some people who have never heard this thesis before, they don't understand, well, why would they want more regulation? Well, because the bigger firms can more easily afford to hire a team of lawyers and accountants to comply with all the new regulations. So that it keeps, their smaller competitors from nipping at their heels. And so that's what always happens in these instances. And again, the fundamental thing here is to say, to ensure financial transparency and integrity, we need more regulations and rules from Washington, D.C. That doesn't make any sense. That's obviously that's not the group of people who are good with money and who are honest. And so the idea that they're going to enforce discipline on other people, that's crazy.
Well, apart from the regulatory landscape, there's also the idea of what would constitute a sound business practice in banking. You know, is a crypto exchange a bank? Not exactly, but it sure operates a lot like one, especially when it starts leveraging its assets to create liquidity for other investments or even for lending. And what occurred earlier this week sure looks like a bank run in the sense that investors in FTX got spooked by some of the things that were coming out, some of the disclosures. And again, this all started on Twitter, not in the mainstream media. And so they started wanting to get their funds out. And so Mr. Bankman was left unable to do that. So it begins to look and feel an awful lot like banks. So I want to let people take a look at this clip. It's by a great friend of ours, Caitlin Long, who's a friend of the Mises Institute, also an early pioneer in Bitcoin. And she went home to her native Wyoming and started, helped the Wyoming legislature craft legislation for crypto banks in the state. And she started a full reserve Bitcoin bank called Avanti. And so she brings up this whole idea of whether the ethos of Bitcoin, or at least other cryptos too, ought to allow fractional reserve lending. And she discusses it in the context of what Mises called commodity credit versus circulation credit. This is about a year ago, and on the panel with her is none other than Sam Bankman-Fried. So, Clay, why don't we run that video real quick? I think you're going to enjoy this.
Satoshi gave us money that isn't debt. And philosophically, why would you put debt on something? I like to use the phrase, a fool and their leveraged Bitcoin are soon parted. Again, a fool and their leveraged Bitcoin are soon parted. And the excesses that we've seen in this bull market are coming from a lot of leverage that didn't happen in the previous bull market, right? We had the ICO issue in the previous bull market. This bull market, it's leverage, right? We've seen more volatility. And one of the big issues with that is that even those of us who are not leveraged have the downside of the fact that the price is more volatile precisely because of the running of stops in these leverage drawdowns, which we've just seen over the last month. It increases the cost of capital for everybody in the industry when Bitcoin's price is more volatile as a result of the impact of leverage moving it around. Avanti is fundamentally committed to not using leverage. And if you're interested in understanding why, philosophically, I really would encourage you to go read Mises. Go understand the difference between commodity credit and circulation credit. Commodity credit is absolutely fine. It's not leverage. Going one-to-one leverage is fine. Anything that is circulation credit that goes above one times leverage, in other words, certainly 100-to-1 leverage is way, you know, is 99% circulation credit, right? That is creating claims to the underlying out of thin air. It is fractional reserve banking. And we are fundamentally committed to not doing that. It is ultimately a commitment to solvency instead of liquidity. And what we've seen in this bull market is a lot of folks are obsessed with liquidity. Satoshi didn't create anything that was designed to be leveraged and really didn't care about liquidity. One of the biggest takeaways that I have from this conference is what Nick Szabo said yesterday, when he said liquidity is a nice to have for a store of value, but not a necessity. You need to be able to use it when you need it, but do we need all this daily liquidity that's driven by trading? Go back and listen to Nick's speech and go read your Mises and learn about circulation credit.
Sam, do you agree?
Look, you can take the position leverage is bad. I don't believe that, but one could believe that. It's not a crazy thing to think. However, were you to think that, I think you'd probably also have to be willing to sacrifice more than most people realize in order to get there. I think you have had to sacrifice the majority of the growth that the industry has had to date if you're to make that trade, and that might be worth it, right? If you think that it is very bad to have leverage in the system, that might be a trade-off worth having. But you can't just look at the drop from 60K to 40K and blame it on leverage without remembering that the run-up from 10K to 60K involved leverage
absolutely
as well.
Absolutely.
And we ended up higher than we started. And so just think about what you're throwing out, you know, with the bad parts. You know, think about the collateral damage.
Well said.
So, Bob, Caitlin's sounding pretty prescient now, just a year later.
Yeah, yeah. It's my buddy sent me that clip last night, actually, and it was the first time I had seen it. And I was just, as I was watching, I was like, oh, wow, Caitlin's on a panel with him. Let's hope it gets juicy. And the more she was saying that, she's telling this crowd, a live audience, about Mises and commodity credit. And I was, oh, yes, this is great. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's to the extent that people are turning over their assets to this entity, the exchange, and then they believe they have, it's like a demand deposit. Mm-hmm. They have instant access to it. They think they're acting in a custodial manner. Then yes, that would be like a checking account or demand deposit. And so, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the Rothbardian tradition of banking theory that says if it's a demand deposit, a true checking account, then the bank shouldn't be lending that out to other people. You know, that there's a different type of account you would have for that. That would be like a savings account or a time deposit. And those are different economic functions. On the one hand, it's just holding your money and allowing you to just deploy it more conveniently. And if that's what's going on, then they can't be lending it out to somebody else, because that's what makes a bank run possible. I mean, people are talking about it like, well, that's just the nature of banking. And no, that's the nature of fractional reserve banking. If they have 100% reserves, a bank run's not a threat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the basic point Caitlin was getting at. And then, of course, Sam Bankman comes along and says, well, let's not, you know, downplay the benefits of leverage. And, you know, and by using that term leverage, they sort of, I think, distort, you know, what it is. So in general, yeah, you can have leverage and that's riskier than not having leverage. But I think there's a fundamental difference between if people are giving you money thinking it's there for them, you know, that it's just safekeeping in a custodial manner. That's a separate thing qualitatively than just, you know, a company borrowing other people's money and then making an investment and hoping that they earn enough to pay them back the loan.
Well, so we're going to link to the little section in Theory of Money and Credit by Mises, over 100 years old now, where he gets into this idea in the part three of the book, the difference between commodity credit and circulation credit. And also he gives a very nice one or two sentence definition of fiduciary media, which we can basically say are, you know, unbacked money substitute. So, you know, I don't think exchanges are per se evil, whether you like Bitcoin or whether you like other so-called cryptos. I think there might be a reason or a market for normies, especially, to want to use an exchange rather than futzing with a wallet and keys and all that. I think that's dangerous, but that's my personal opinion. And I won't name any names. There are exchanges that are levered and don't have your Bitcoin or whatever if everybody wanted to demand it the same day. And then there are exchanges which are one-to-one and literally keep all of the coins deposited. So that, you know, that just depends. But, I mean, here's the scenario, Bob. Yeah. You know, this FTX bankruptcy send some tremors throughout the economy. We already see slowdowns in and some layoffs in some big tech companies, like Amazon, for example. You know, that a retail company you would think was pretty immune from a recession, but not so necessarily. So there's going to be some public sentiment, especially from average people, to regulate this and to do something. And so one thing they might do is say, well, you know, okay, unlike 2008, these digital forms of currency, they really are here and there's nothing we can do to stop them. But what we ought to do is make sure that these cowboy private tech bros are not out there doing this on their own. We ought to have our own central bank issue them. And of course, this has been discussed by a lot of people. There have been members of Congress who have actually argued that we shouldn't have private banks like Wells Fargo. Everyone's account should be with the Fed. There's also the reality that most U.S. dollars, whether those are in your various accounts or your money market or your IRA, your 401k, you know, your Schwab, money market account, whatever it might be, CDs, most U.S. dollars are already digital. You know, only a small percentage of U.S. dollars exist in physical form as a paper bill or a coin. So we already have a digital currency in that sense. But a central bank digital currency is a little bit of a different animal. And none other than Neil Kashkari, who is the president of the Minneapolis Fed, had this to say when asked about central bank digital currencies and pointing out why the American people might not want them. So inadvertently, because he's not one of us, he was making a pretty libertarian argument against them. So Clay, let's roll that clip from Neil Kashkari.
I mean, as the my colleagues at the Federal Reserve have talked about, we are examining it. I'll tell you, my personal bias is I'm pretty skeptical. I keep asking anybody at the Fed or outside of the Fed to explain to me what problem this is solving. I can send anybody in this room $5 with Venmo right now, right? No, seriously. So what is it that a CBDC could do that Venmo can't do? And all I get is a bunch of hand waving. I get a bunch, well, maybe it's better for financial inclusion. Maybe it's better for cross-border remittances. Maybe. Is there any evidence that it is? And, you know, they say, well, what about China? China's doing it. Well, I can see why China would do it. If they want to monitor every one of your transactions, you could do that with the central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. If you want to impose negative interest rates, you could do that with the central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. And if you want to directly tax customer accounts, you could do that with the central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. So I get why China would be interested. Why would the American people be for that? You know, so anyway, I think the crypto space broadly is 95% noise, hype, and confusion. I'm leaving open the 5% possibility that something useful could come from it. I'm still waiting.
Well, Bob, I like that. I mean, basically saying the only thing that these things are good for is to monitor people, to tax people, and to charge them negative interest rates. But I mean, look, this is a guy who, I remember one time he was talking about the reason we have all these various feds is because they ought to be sensitive, more localized, more regionalized. They ought to be sensitive to the concerns of the area. So the San Francisco Fed needs to be concerned about climate change because California is literally burning. And, you know, the Chicago Fed needs to be concerned with racism because there's so much racism in Chicago. I mean, this is not a guy who's normally equipped to say what we would consider sensible things. But yet he has this to say about central bank digital currencies. I think they are absolutely terrifying, and I think we're asleep at the switch on this one.
Well, yeah, and also, Jeff, with this guy, wasn't he was involved somehow with the bailouts, wasn't he? Because I just remember everyone was making fun of his name. Like, the guy they're putting in, you know, in this is Neil Kashkari. Like, that just seems like out of a Austin Powers movie or something. But, right, and it is refreshing. I mean, because a lot of these guys, you know, these little sort of, the people who have to go implement these policies, like the government, they don't hire just a bunch of bumbling fools. Like, if they need to get something done that requires technical expertise, yeah, they get some smart people mm-hmm. to go ahead and do it. So yeah, when they are frank and just talk about how the thing's going to work, it is refreshing to hear them coming out of their lips as well. But more generally, yes. I mean, this push to get rid of cash, you know, and that one element of that is this central bank digital currency. That's exactly what the reason is, that, you know, they'll say, oh, because drug dealers and, mm-hmm. oh, we want to be able to charge negative interest rates because otherwise. But yes, it's a matter of control. And again, for people just to just think through, I mean, the warning about, oh, the Chinese government and these ESG and social credit scores and all that stuff. Can you imagine it? Because they wouldn't even have to arrest you. There wouldn't have to be fines. All the government has to do is if you are behaving in ways they don't like, they don't have to directly infringe on your freedom. They can just make an announcement to all the merchants and say, this person's someone we don't care for, and we would prefer you not to do business with them. And, you know, mm-hmm. in a private, you know, private business can refrain from doing, but, you know, it's like kind of how they're leaning on Twitter to kick somebody off. You know, it would be that sort of arrangement. So it would not be as easy for a lawyer to come in and say, this person's having his rights violated, even though he wasn't convicted of a crime. So yeah, well, as we're moving towards this, mm-hmm. the monitoring and just their ability to lean on people and just shut down or heavily discourage, it'd be like just, you know, it'd be like you having a blockade around you. You know how right now, like there's sanctions on Russia. This would be a way for them just to put sanctions on individuals and just make it really hard for them to interact in terms of commercial relations with anybody. And again, without due process. So it's very scary just the amount of power this would give. And I think it's incredibly naive if people say, oh, yeah, okay, sure, there's that. But, I mean, look at all the efficiencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very similar to metadata collection with, the, like, for instance, the cell phone companies. to, you know, there's Fourth Amendment implications apart from due process. If the government is basically monitoring your whereabouts through your phone, let's say, or it's basically monitoring your financial activity through a digital currency, you know, doesn't it need to present some sort of reasonable suspicion, some sort of articulable facts that there's something criminal is happening? I would argue they certainly do under the Fourth Amendment. So this is not immediately going to be just the Fed taking over,
just,
right?
Just real quick on that. Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, on that, just on that quick line of point, I mean, this is a simple observation, but it is, I just notice sometimes, like if I'm going and looking, we bought a house recently and I had to give, you know, the bank, because I'm not actually worth $919 million, Jeff, even though I should be, but inefficient capital markets. And, you know, you got to turn over, and I was just looking over like the actual, like they wanted 3 months of my checking account. And I was looking at like, they know a lot about me. And they were coming back and asking like, well, what's this for? What, you know, you paid this to this person. Why do you owe them money? What is it? And it just seeing 3 months of just my one checking account card, that doesn't even capture all of my transactions, that, yeah, you know, all kinds of stuff about someone if you can just follow their financial transactions. So yeah, the idea that the government would have that, and what, they're just going to say, oh, don't worry, we promise, unless, you know, we went to get a warrant on you, we won't look. I mean, that's, come on.
And that's exactly what they do say with, for instance, cell phone data. They say, look, you know, until you do something, we're not going to take a look at that. So, okay, but I don't necessarily trust you. And in the interim, what they're going to do to make this more palatable, they're not immediately going to say your Bank of America or your Wells Fargo bank account is no more. Now that's your Fed account. What they're going to partner with these banks. And I saw this news item yesterday. MasterCard, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and others launched a 12-week experimental digital dollar pilot with the New York Fed. So that's how it will begin, a public-private partnership. You know, if there's any institutions which are not truly private, it's got to be banks. I mean, they are regulated by the federal government to the part where they might as well be partners. And believe you me, they will snitch on you all day long, warrant or no warrant, I suspect. But I mean, this is going to happen in a way that the American people clamor for it, right? I mean, if you engineer another crisis, another financial crisis similar to 2008, I mean, let's take 2008's crisis with today's political divisions. I think that would be far nastier, even if the economic pain was just roughly the same. So there's a lot to consider here in the sense that our federal government's capabilities in the digital sphere at least match those of, you know, people out there in the crypto space trying to break away from government eyes, trying to denationalize currency, trying to create truly private money. You know, I'm not so sure that governments and central banks are going to allow that without a fight.
Yeah, and just to your point before about, you know, the government snitching on, or sorry, the bank snitching to the government. I mean, there's stuff right now about, you know, I guess it's under the Patriot Act is probably where that it came from. You know, you can't take out too much money from your bank account. And if you do, like, they'll sit you down and talk to you. What do you need it for? Why are you taking out such a large withdrawal? And da, 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 da. And if you just go to the ATM and you're doing it, if it comes above a certain threshold, the bank has to report that to the government to say, hey, there's an unusual pattern. And ostensibly say, oh, because you could be funding terrorism. But obviously, it's just to keep tabs on everybody. And I forget the guy's name. I don't remember, know if this was on your radar, but there was some coach that he got caught that he had been doing something, you know, improper with a boy that was on his team like decades earlier, and then was being blackmailed and was paying them, and he went to his ATM and he was structuring his withdrawals so that it wouldn't trigger the automatic reporting. And then that's actually what he got prosecuted on, because the statute of limitations had run off on the, you know, the actual crime, assuming it happened. And so, I mean, there's stuff right now where, yeah, if you take your money out and if you do it, like if you do it deliberately to not trigger the reporting, if you strategically withdraw because you know what the rules are, then that itself is a crime. I mean, it's really amazing that you can't even take out your own money without it being a criminal. So they're already doing things that are just nutty.
Well, that's how they got Rush Limbaugh. They charged him with structuring. he was taking cash out to buy opioids. Because it turns out street opioid dealers prefer cash in those transactions. And I mean, we can go all the way back. The Patriot Act did intensify this. We can go all the way back to 1972, the Bank Secrecy Act. And that was what first created the idea of reporting cash transactions above $10,000. And originally, that only applied to banks and financial institutions. Later on, that bill was amended to apply to things like car dealers or jewelry dealers, anywhere where you had big ticket items that might be more than $10,000. Now, what's so Orwellian and draconian about that is not just the surveillance, but if we took that $10,000 limit, in 1972, you could go into a Cadillac dealership and a brand new Caddy was like 10. Okay. Mm. So if you adjust that for inflation, you should be able to deal in cash up to like $60,000-$70,000 relative to 1972 dollars without anyone being notified. So, but we still have the $10,000 limit. We still have what's called a SAR, a suspicious activity report, which is basically deputizing every jewelry dealer, every automobile dealer, every junior bank teller at your bank to be a junior G-man and tell Uncle Sam when you are transacting, you know, more than $10,000 in cash. And of course, very, 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 very few of those SARs ever result in a criminal investigation, much less a criminal indictment. I mean, the percentage is so tiny. So the injury done to our privacy does not yield all these prosecutions of drug dealers or terrorists or something. It's just absolute make-work and absolute prying. But I guarantee you that federal officials use that as leverage against criminal defendants of all kinds. And so that's a really bad system. But even when the amount involved is not 10,000, in other words, if you went in and like Rush Limbaugh did, you did, you know, for several days in a row, you came in and took out five or something. They're not only allowed, they're supposed to write that up as well. So there's a whole noose of financial regulations, know your customer, you know, which require basically financial institutions to act as snitches. So at this point, I'm not sure that the American public values privacy all that much. And I think that if we have a significant economic downturn, that there will be plenty of public support, you know, for getting these crypto bros. You know, they tried to go offshore. They tried to leave the country. I could see them being a very convenient scapegoat, but it'll all come back to bite the rest of us.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly how they're going to play. I mean, you can just see how Robert Reich or Bernie Sanders are talking about corporate greed, you know, on Twitter right now for, you know, look at these inflation numbers and the corporate greed is what's causing all this. And so, right, yeah, the economic pain intensifies. They're going to find some anecdotes. And I agree with you, too, that they have to be a little bit cautious on this particular one because the guy was such a big donor to Democrats and he was with the effective altruism movement and all this stuff. And he was a darling of the media, financial types. And so it's a little bit awkward for them that it was him. But yeah, look at how they're treating Elon Musk, for example. I mean, so yeah, when one of these guys goes down and it's a right winger who has some, you know, writings about libertarianism or I don't trust the government, then yeah, then it's going to just be all hell's going to break loose.
Well, I will say this, but you know, Neil Kashkari went to Wharton and Samuel Bankman-Fried went to MIT. So I think we need a moratorium on all these schools. No more graduates of these schools should be hired anywhere until we can figure out what the hell is going on. So we're going to list links to the two clips we showed, one from the great Caitlin Long, our friend out in Wyoming, and one from the horrible, awful, no good Neil Kashkari, president of the Minneapolis Fed. But we're also going to provide a link to the HTML portion of that section of Mises's theory of money and credit. I think if you go give that section a read, you might develop a taste to read the book in its entirety. And it's just an incredibly prescient book, considering it was written really before the era of modern central banking in the West. So all that said, Bob, it's great to see you. As always, ladies and gentlemen, have a great weekend.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. And in the meantime, you can find more content like this at Mises.org.